Welcome everyone to the special episode of Kiwi Talks to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Metroid Prime 2. Good way to feel old. I'm honored to have one of the original designers, Kynan Pearson. He's back. Thanks, my man, for coming back. How you doing?
Doing really good. Thanks for having me back as well. It's exciting. It is crazy that it's 20 years, but you know, I've just been kind of looking back on it and thinking a lot about development and it doesn't feel like it's that long ago.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It feels like time just flies by. Apparently, time goes faster as you get older.
Yep.
I definitely feel that.
Absolutely true. Can confirm.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to start off with is the actual design of Metroid Prime 2, right? Because the original Metroid Prime was basically a 3D reimagining of Super Metroid, the multi-layered labyrinth, so to speak. But it felt like with Metroid Prime 2, you guys kind of went for like a more Zelda dungeon-esque type of design. Like you stay in one area for the most part, and then you move to another biome, and then you move to another biome. But I wanted to know how that came about, the structure originally.
Yes. So in a certain regard, you know, Retro had gotten feedback from players that enjoyed Prime 1 in regards to just hearing if people got lost or whatever was happening. And because the themes of Prime 2 being the dark light world at the same time were more complicated in nature, we had to simplify the structure of the game. And that was done so that it would make it easier for people to compensate with the more difficult gameplay and the themes, but also to differentiate it structurally completely from Prime 1, because you don't want to just rebuild the exact same game again.
Yeah, and it would be boring from a development standpoint as well, because you've already tread that ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think they covered Super Metroid in 3D really well. Prime 2 was about differentiating because it was going to be released on the same exact console. It was kind of a darker second chapter, a popular thing to say at the time. And so if you really think about, you know, like where to go and what to provide, it needed to differentiate itself almost like Majora's Mask did from Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, it's good comparison.
And so there were some similar themes at play. Also, Tanabe-san and the group that we worked with at the time, SPD, had worked on various Nintendo franchises, and so there was a mutual understanding of terminology, mechanics that we'd like to pursue. And that's how we ended up there.
Because Tanabe-san actually worked on Link to the Past, didn't he?
He did.
A number of the folks did. So what was some of the advice or feedback they gave you?
Every Nintendo game is realistically its own thing. So there isn't really a through line or a thread to other games, except maybe in discussing how a mechanic works or whatnot. So we did discuss A Link to the Past, the dark world, basically light world themes of that game, how there's a transition point, the environments have transformation. But, you know, it's not based on that, so everything within Prime 2 had to stand on its own merits and validate itself. So we couldn't just say, oh, because this game did this, we're going to do this. No, it was really about the discovery improving. And there was a lot of experimentation early on in defining what the look was and how to pull those systems together.
Yeah, because how early were the biomes set? You know, because you kind of got desert, swamp, and futuristic.
We established those really early, and it was mostly like a combination of it was a collaboration between art and design on things that would be interesting artistically, the stuff that was working out in terms of new experiments and basically beautiful corners that were being developed and some of the stuff taking advantage of things that could be a little stranger and push it a little further. So those themes were established very early on. The look of Dark World, however, went through some radical kind of alterations where some of the versions, and maybe I've discussed this before, but one of the versions was like the world was almost completely silhouetted and you could only see where you were going based on the contrast of light sources or of the sky, creating the forms and silhouettes. And so it was super cool, looked incredible, but, you know, posed some difficult problems to surmount with the tech that we had at the time and basically the experiments that we had done.
Well, wouldn't the design be hard as well? Because it would be, I think I remember Jack saying this, like doing platforming in that type of environment would almost be impossible because you can't see anything.
Yeah. We had an edge outliner, but for the most part, yeah. When it was pitch black, when it was literal silhouette, there were problems that we just didn't solve well enough to feel confident that we could pull that off in the whole game. So we, you know, adjusted the look accordingly and figured things out as we went to make sure that it worked based on what we were doing gameplay-wise and visually.
Because how do you do, obviously there must be so much testing and prototyping in terms of like, okay, I'm going to go into this room. There's going to be a lot of platforms to jump in this room. Maybe this room will have puzzles or some morph ball puzzles. This one will have more combat. Like, how do you work out where to put that? Because obviously it's modular in nature as well. So you can move the rooms around.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, there's the natural part, which is playing up the skills of the people that we have working on stuff. And then also their personal motivation and interest. So if you can prove something and you can do it well, then it makes the cut, it goes in. And so when we would do planning, we would plan to make sure that we had evenly dispersed elements. So like, you know, morph ball tunnels and ability usages and all of that stuff. But then when it comes down to actually digging in on the room, then the personalities of the designers, the artists, everybody working in the space kind of comes out and you're just like, it'd be super cool if we did this. And so like my personal interest, morph ball tunnels and morph ball configurations, because it's like such a core to the Metroid experience. And so I would try to push doing the craziest stuff that I could with morph ball tunnels as often as I could. I wanted to litter my rooms with morph ball configurations, probably to painful result, because I would push certain things that didn't necessarily have great camera solutions in the initial setup. So I know I drove Ryan Harris crazy with that and Mark HH, but the camera system in the Prime games is literally the most robust, best camera system that I'd ever worked with. And still to this day, there are things that like I'd love to do on projects that I work on that just don't have the quality, polish, and attention to detail that the Prime Morph Ball camera had.
Well, it does feel like with Prime 2, it's almost like Prime 1's puzzles on steroids. You know, everything. I mean, particularly when you get to the Sanctuary Fortress and a lot of the cool stuff you do with the Spider Ball and the Boost Ball and stuff. So I'm guessing you that was a lot of experimentation and iteration and you just wanting to just push it as far as you can.
Yeah, and I didn't do all of it. Like Michael Chang had some super cool rooms, especially in Sanctuary Fortress. It was taking advantage of basically the things that had been learned and what we could do, especially with the changes that we made to boosting off of the tracks.
Yeah.
So that was cool because you could effectively frame things and you could make these big, you know, exaggerated leaps from one structure to another by boosting. And then the time stuff and just basically the scripting systems that we had to push the elements further than they had before. And so we looked at all these cool things that we now had in the toolkit from Prime 1 going into Prime 2. And then it was like, okay, now sky's the limit. How do we actually take it further? How do we push those elements and exaggerate and actually swing for the fences a little more in the configurations that we're putting together so that, you know, it's more memorable? One of the things, and you know, whether or not this was a failing or a success, was you try to incorporate things that make it difficult for you to go back. And I know that generally the audience at large prefers Prime 1, but for the people that do love Prime 2 for what it does, being a more difficult game, being a darker game, requiring more of the player, the players that do get that experience from Prime 2 love it. And it was something that we, having had all of the experience playing, played up on the mechanics a lot more and pushed things a lot further. So it's trying to do stuff that it's like, okay, cool. Like, this is unique, distinct, memorable, and is something that couldn't have been done in the prior game.
So is this confirmed, or you decide to do this very early on? Like, do you map this out on like a whiteboard? I'm like, okay, what do we do in Prime 1? How can we expand on this? and somebody comes up with the idea of boosting across spiderable tracks?
Oh, no, it's actually just blocking. So we had metrics for everything. So everything was done by intention. So from an engineering perspective, things were created with limitations. Design would also work heavily on, you know, presenting things and detailing out what the constraints are. So the idea of the boost ball is about, one, just have, like, boost off of, let's say, spiral ball track, as an example, is how do you control it so that after you've boosted, you don't gain control midair and you're going to miss a target that you go to. And so it's first figure out the constraints to make sure that it's easy for players to do the coolest stuff in the game. And then it's like tuning the values of, like, you know, do when you boost, does it just kind of drop off with heavy gravity? Does it lighten gravity and, like, just keep you going across? Does it take gravity over time and arc you down? And so that's a lot of the feel. And then once you have the feel nailed, then that creates your metrics so that whenever you block in levels in the design process, you just test it over and over and over. And so you'd go to the very end and you'd be like, if I boost from here, do I still hit? If I go here and I boost, do I still hit? If I go all the way up to the end and I hold up so that the ball is kind of coming off of the end, do we expect it to boost up or do you still want it to boost across? And so that's a lot of things that have to be resolved in a way that's consistent and meets players' expectations, but also provides, you know, the playfulness of variability so that when it's all said and done, you have it laid out in design blocking, then it goes through art, that everything comes together and that the mechanics actually work in a way that's satisfying to you and isn't just buggy or gives you some weird outcome. And again, you don't solve all of them, but you solve as many as you find along the way and make sure that you address any problem areas and simplify things down if something comes up where it's just not working out. Or you put a secret pickup as a result of the unexpected thing that happens, and then that way it actually becomes an intention.
Well, I would imagine then that was the case a lot in Sanctuary Fortress, because there are a lot of pickups that involve that sort of thing with the spider ball and boost ball.
Yeah, those are all created with intention. It's more along the lines of, like, whenever we're doing white paper testing, or whenever we'd have people come in and play, friends and family or other devs seeing stuff for the first time. If there was something that we'd noticed that people were consistently doing over and over, where it's like, oh, somebody's supposed to jump here onto this upper platform, but then they fall and then they run around down there. We saved a reserve of, like, pickups, so that we could go like, oh, well, everyone's falling down here, so why don't we reward that behavior and actually put a little morphball tunnel down there that leads to a missile pickup. And then that way it feels like you're taking the thing that's naturally happening in the game and turning it into a rewarding loop of, like, it's acknowledging players for, I tried this, this happened, and oh, I feel smart because I just found this secret location, instead of, eh, I made a mistake, and it's the game's fault. And now I wish they had just built this jump configuration better so that I wasn't constantly falling here.
And that's an interesting point you make about, like, puzzles and making the player feel smart, because you want to design a puzzle that's not too easy, but you don't want it to be too hard so they find it frustrating.
Yeah.
And so I suppose a lot of testing just to make sure that that's right?
A lot of testing to make sure that it's right. Typically, design is about perception. So at least looking at it from my perspective, when you're building a space, you're going to have a lot of players of a lot of different skill sets doing a lot of different things. They're not always going to do exactly what you expect. So there are measures you can take to drive them to do things, even if they don't realize you're doing them. And then that way it feels like they feel accomplished because they're not getting super hung up and lost in ways that are frustrating and just, you know, unplayable. But after, let's just say you do a block in and it's like, okay, cool, got this entire thing planned out. The entire focal point of what you can see when you walk into this room is that exit right over there, but you don't know how to get to that exit and it seems out of reach. But then if you follow what you can see, that leads you to an area that then you turn the corner and you see the start to how you're going to get over there. So it's about leaving breadcrumbs visually, because the game is, you are playing a camera. And so as long as you're guiding exactly where players are looking and you're following where they're looking from their goal, to the destination or the place that they want to start their journey to get there, then that's created intentionally. If you just lay out a bunch of stuff and you just expect people to kind of like wander around and find things, then that's unintentional. So yeah. You don't know what the outcome is going to be there. But if you do leave players with all of the tools necessary to solve a puzzle, to be like, that's a destination I want to reach. What's the start point? What leads to that? And as long as there's clarity there, then you can push the limits and do things that are more cerebral, that require more thought. But there has to be some connection to what you're doing and why it is resulting in a solution to the problem that you're trying to deal with. Mm. And then when you take it through the art process, sometimes those things where it's like, you need to make the art focus on the area that is critical to gameplay. So for instance, if we have a morph ball tunnel that is critical to you proceeding because you need to go through it to find a switch, to open a door, or to trigger an event, then that needs to be absolutely obvious. So we'll do things like run a wire into the morph ball tunnel and have scrolling UVs that are guiding you in there. Or you look in the room and the lighting looks great and it looks beautiful and crafted, but the tunnel is illuminated more than anything else. So it's literally about absolute control over the visual qualities that you see and your understanding of the elements at play. Because you're in an alien environment, and so things aren't going to contextually make sense. Like, oh yeah, it's a refrigerator, so I just pull the handle and the refrigerator door opens. No, it's like, there's this giant, you know, elaborate, ornate, what I think might be a wall or a gateway, and then there's cords leading from it to a control terminal. And then it's like, okay, so if I use that control terminal, maybe it'll do something with this device, but I don't know exactly what it's going to do. But when you do it, and then it acknowledges your action, and it turns out to be cooler than just opening a fridge door, then it's rewarding and it's cool, and it's about discovery.
That's cool. One of the things that I really love about Metroid Prime 2 is the unique items or upgrades it has compared to the rest of the series, particularly at that point in time as well, because the standard thing was, you know, you start off in the normal suit, then you get Varia suit, in the gravity suit, and then even the beams, wave beam, plasma beam, all that sort of thing. And you guys really went to town on coming up with unique upgrades. Can you talk about a bit of that process and how you decided on some of that stuff, like the dark suit and light suit and the dark beam and light beam and echo visor and stuff?
So there were a ton of things. First off, there's experiments happening all over the place with people just kind of having ideas and stuff. Sometimes it's intentional where it's like, hey, we would love to have a visor that works kind of like this, but does this. Other times it'll be, you know, a rendering trick that somebody discovers. And then it's like, ooh, we could do something with that. And so I loved working with Andy O'Neill, and he was a beast. He's incredible at mechanics, the feel of things, and he's super smart, highly technical. And so he was doing stuff like, let's just say, the beams. So dark beam, I don't know if I've ever talked about this, but the first version of dark beam that we had, because we had the ing puddles that would guide along the walls, and the dark beam would leave the dark splat that would kind of go out, and then it would target the nearest enemy, and it would spiral around them and eventually freeze them. So that made it through into the game, but the first version we had was all of these dynamic particles that would actually just burst out and have a much more significant range. So they would seek out like two or three enemies simultaneously and freeze them. And like it was always satisfying to watch because it was basically a mechanic that had some form of procedural element with where the particles displaced out and what they would naturally choose to seek. So it almost looked like swarming. And Andy had put that together, and it was so OP and so satisfying to use that I wish people could have seen it. Like, I wish we could have done something more with it to like ship it that way, but it was just so good we had to scale it back. It's about coming up with what makes something memorable and variable so that you can use it in a bunch of different circumstances, that it has some form of acknowledgement in the world for puzzle solving, so doors or some form of mechanic that allows it to do something interesting. And then it's just running through, like making sure that two things aren't repeating the same mechanic for, you know, so that everything has its variety, it has its place, it has its highlight moment. And so a lot of times for the beams, it's about how does it interact with the world? How does it interact with enemies? How does it fire and feel differently whenever you just fire it regularly or charge it or have eventually a super beam version of that? How is that absolutely differentiated from this other form? Or in the case of I can't remember, it was dark beam, light beam, and what was the third?
Annihilator.
Annihilator.
Yeah.
So Annihilator was a combination of dark and light together. So it was like, it was advantageous, but in order to balance that out, so why would you not just use Annihilator beam at all times? The ammo system kind of came up where it created this interplay, kind of like Ikaruga, between dark and light and ammunitions of each type, so that there are effective times to use certain things and effective times to use other, and that one gives you ammo for the opposite, so that it creates this interplay between what you're doing. And so those are just interesting elements that come up as we try to differentiate, try to create a unique system that ties into the fiction of the world, working very closely with SPD, and then also just basically a great combination between design having an absolute understanding of the elements of the sandbox that allow us to do various puzzle solving, and having such a killer technical crew on the engineering side to pull off magic back then on hardware that, you know, ultimately was not the strongest in the market.
But no,
the Prime games were definitely impressive. And then the art team being able to pull off an art vision that really stood out from what was available at the time. So we had stuff running 60 frames a second with interesting mechanics going off and beautifully framed by fantastic art direction.
Did you get to work on any of the bosses?
Yeah, I did. I built a lot of the boss environment. So I built the Chikachich room. I built the Quadraxis room. I worked on the, Amorbis room. I think Jason might have built the original version of that. Echo Visor room, where you get the dark, where you fight Dark Samus and get the Echo Visor. The power bomb room, where you're fighting against the thing that's firing power bombs while you're on the spider ball tracks.
Quite a bit of stuff then.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, again, we had Jason Bear, Michael Chang, and I as the three primary level designers. We had Chip work on some stuff as well, but for the most part, it was like, I'd built about a third of the blue rooms. So again, we would have Russell and Tom Ivey and some of the other designers do scripting after we did the blue room block-in. But then I would also work with engineers to go through ideas for, you know, various things that happen during boss battles. But in some regards, it really, like, you know, I wouldn't be responsible for the entire implementation of something.
No,
it
no.
was only like, here's you know, how the platforms work in the Chikachich, the Chika battle, and how the grapple points come down. And so this is spaced out for the mechanics to work like this. But then, you know, a lot of other talented people would go through and finalize the scripting, the behaviors, and all of that, set up cinematics afterwards. So,
because how do you decide how big to make a room when you're designing some of these rooms, you know, like the Chicken room or the Quadraxis room?
So there's initial intent. Like, you'll put together something, you'll play test it to make sure that it feels good for player movement and for what's being possible. And so if the boss has interactive elements, so for instance, you know, Quadraxis has the spider ball tracks that launch you onto the head as it's flying around. So that stuff has to be blocked in and measured out to make sure that it works before it gets implemented into a dynamic 3D character rig. So a lot of times you'll block in something as like, okay, this is basically the mass of what the boss is in the room as it's built. And then you have to make changes accordingly as it goes through the concept arting process, animation, rigging, previs, mechanics, and all that stuff. So sometimes a boss will start at one size and then you'll scale it up because it just works better that way. But yeah, there's a lot of elements that go into it, and a lot of it is just refining. Like, basically, it's like you build an armature of what you're putting in, and then slowly but surely you build it up and change it and make adjustments and improve it over and over and over and over until you've got something that is that you're proud of, that basically leaves a lasting impression. So it's not a science per se, as like you set it up at first and it just works. It really is a refinement process. Make it better, make it better, make it better every step.
So would there be often cases where you'd scale up? Because some of the bosses in Prime 2 are big.
Yeah.
They're quite big. So was the original size smaller, or were they always that big? Or was it a case where because of the room it was so big, you'd scale it up accordingly?
I can't answer definitively for all aspects, because a lot of people are making decisions. So if I was like, oh yeah, no, everything was as the size, I'd be lying, because so many people are working on things so often. And it's like, I was constantly in everybody's office and aware of what's going on, but not necessarily driving, or I can't even remember with 100% accuracy now at this point, some of the micro changes. But the intent for Quadraxis was always to be big. And Emperor Ng needed to have a scale that worked really well with basically being a follow-up to the Metroid Prime fight. I think the camera kind of and the controls restricted some of the heights that something could be, because you'd have to comfortably have enough room in the room to be able to backpedal, lock on, and not be disoriented. So if you had something that's too big in a small room, and you had to manually press a button to start aiming up, because we didn't have dual analog as the primary control scheme back then, it dictated a lot of the scale just through the mechanics of what works best with the control scheme. So the control scheme was very much jumping flash, which I don't know if you remember that original PlayStation 1 game, but you know, it had a button to be able to free look around, and they did camera assist when you would jump to let you see platforms as you're coming down. So it's got more in similar with jumping flash than it did with something like Halo.
It is interesting how limitations create such creative problem solving, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly back in those days. I think that some of the best things are created through applying limitations instead of just going, we can do anything. It's knowing what you can do and actually concentrating more on what you do well than what you can't do well. And so you could just start a game and be like, in this production, we're going to do everything. We're going to have vehicles you get into and all this stuff, and it's going to be open world and whatever. That doesn't always lead to the best experience. So it's knowing what, you know, it's applying some limitations that give you interesting gameplay mechanics and dynamics to work with, and then pushing those as far as you can once you have those limitations in place. Because sometimes those limitations actually create opportunities to do things that other games can't. And, you know, so even though this isn't necessarily Prime 2 related, but like on the Donkey Kong, on Donkey Kong Country Returns, because we had a flat, you know, world that was 100% left to right, up and down with no, you know, in and out, we were able to frame things like the tidal waves coming in or stuff where it'd be much more difficult to do that if you didn't have absolute control over what the player could see, where you could turn the camera. Because in a game like Donkey Kong, if you could just rotate the camera around the other way, then you could die from a, you know, tidal wave coming in and pushing you off that you couldn't even see. And so it's a lot about understanding, what does the player have the ability to do? What can they see at all times? How can we drive their attention where it needs to be if we need to, without feeling like we're limiting their control? So modern games take control away a lot more often to like guide your camera to where they want to look, and then you're just not playing anymore. But in classic games, especially in the era that we were building Prime 2, we only did cinematics to establish shots or to show you information after you were interacting with something where it felt appropriate, and not necessarily while you're playing. Then all of a sudden we like guide the camera in to behind Samus's head, or, you know, pull it out and shift your camera angle out of your control to a direction. We would use some cinematics to like set you up in the right looking position to start a boss battle, but boss battles always have to have cool intros, so it feels like a natural extension of that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's interesting. I was reading one of the old Iwata asks with Tanabe-san regarding Metroid Prime 3 and in regards to the whole East and West thing, because he was saying that they both have their different strengths and weaknesses, right? But the strength of like the West is graphics and attention to detail in terms of that sort of thing. But Japanese are very good at the very minute details that Western devs often overlook. But I'm wondering if you can give me an example of something where maybe Tanabe or SPD, they came in and they saw something or attention to something that maybe you guys weren't
aware
of.
That's a hard one, because there's so many things where it's just a back and forth. So like people on staff, it's everyone has different perception of stuff. So it's like a designer working on something might have strong, you know, a sense of awareness of physical spaces, but an artist might have a great sense of rhythm, color palette, and then animator might be able to bring anticipation when an enemy is attacking. So it's not necessarily that I can overgeneralize and say this is a thing that SPD or Nintendo of Japan did well or made us aware of that we didn't have awareness of. There was constant learning on our side of just like, oh, if we, you know, went into something and they had a preference or they brought something to our attention, we would just actually learn it and incorporate it into our process. So it didn't become something that we had to keep getting from them. It was more along the lines of like, oh, cool, this is the way, you know, Nintendo thinks about this mechanic or this design constraint or this artistic element. And it's like, awesome, that's a lesson now that we can apply. But not everyone learns the same lessons or needs to. So we would have people that are specialists that had those understandings that would, when the time came, provide that guidance and feedback to make sure that we had it. So it really does boil down to there's differences in what audiences expected. And there were a lot of things that as Western developers, because we had experience playing first-person shooters, would think about from a much more traditional solution standpoint. So dual analog would have been a natural evolution of where the control scheme could have gone if you just left it up to, you know, a popular vote amongst a Western studio's development team. But there, in Japan, they didn't have as much, like the genre wasn't as popular. So something that controlled a little bit more like a vehicle where you didn't have to worry about constantly looking around at the same time as moving, just felt more natural to, being approachable to a Japanese audience. And also just, you know, from a Nintendo philosophy standpoint, they don't care what other games' control schemes are. They really just want the game to be what it needs to be the best experience that it can be.
Japanese tend to have more of a problem with motion sickness as well. So is that something that you have to factor in? I suppose they'd probably be more aware of it as well and could...
Yeah,
because you test stuff, I'm sure, and you, even if you're fine with it, someone else might be getting motion sickness from it.
Yeah, I mean, I worked a lot in VR post retro, so I know about, you know, motion sickness is a real thing, and it's probably the very reason why VR is never going to do the things that people expect it to do, because the things they expect actually cause motion sickness. So being in first person, running around at full speed and looking, or flying, actually just gets you nauseous. Flat screen experiences suffer from the same thing. And it could be simple tuning of just like too much bob on a camera as you're running can actually make somebody feel nauseous. And it's not necessarily like there's a dramatic difference in audience. It's more that because some, like, Americans got... a resistance to motion sickness by playing games that really caused motion sickness, like Wolfenstein and Doom and Quake and all of these super fast first-person shooters where if you're watching somebody play and you're not in control of what the movements are happening or of what the movements are doing, it actually just, you know, can turn your stomach. But Americans developed a resistance to it just through playing these games that were incredible. And so over time, it was just, you know, a larger part of our audience was more accepting to things that would make anybody else that didn't have experience in the genre sick.
Yeah, it actually makes me think of, I remember speaking to Jack ages ago about Speed Booster and how you wouldn't be able to do it in first person because it would just be barf vision. Like if you're...
That's spoken like somebody who's only thinking about it from a literal perspective. If when you were moving fast, you changed the FOV so that it widened out and made things feel like they were going faster, but then you slowed time to compensate with the speed that you were running, so the world slowed instead of you actually going that literal speed, there's solutions to those problems. But for the most part, yeah, if you just literally did speed boost, you would have to, you'd have to create like a vignette effect that came in on the sides to give a frame of reference. And then you wouldn't allow any turning left or right while you're running just to make sure that you didn't, yeah, cause people to get sick if they could free look while they're speed boosting. There's a bunch of solutions to it, but that's very much the thing that Retro excelled at, was having a very difficult problem to overcome. And then coming up with creative solutions from people that had a fundamental understanding of how mechanics work, and then the limitations to apply to make it possible.
Mm. Smart. Yeah, because I would think the only solution would be to pull out into third person, but you're a smart man. Yeah. That's why you do this stuff and not me.
With that was the way that we got around the Screw Attack.
Yeah.
So Screw Attack, we pulled to third person because we had the Morph Ball camera. We intentionally only allowed you to stay at a, you know, consistent vertical level so that the camera followed in a very stable manner instead of the camera going, which would have just made everybody sick. So, yeah, it was a lot of problem solving with an understanding of why. And it's like having intention behind what's the problem, what are the things you're trying to solve for, and how are you going to make it enjoyable by the biggest audience. The thing is, the Prime games... you know, at least Prime 2 didn't sell to a massive, massive audience, mostly because Metroidvania games are very complicated and require a lot of the audience. So, like, they're not, it's not the most approachable genre. It actually, you know, requires dedicated gamers that want to have the experience of being able to be lost and explore and discover. And, you know, it's a hard thing to sell people on when you have a lot of people that think literally about stuff where they're like, oh, I know what a car is. So it's like Grand Theft Auto is a reflection of the real world. So by its very nature, it can be more approachable to a larger audience than something that's more niche as a concept. Like you are a warrior in armor made by aliens, abandoned on an alien planet, and you have to discover what these alien things that have no relation to anything on Earth do. And then learning how to apply those things that you are learning in the moment to overcoming obstacles that seem like they're beyond your comprehension. So it's like, it is a limited audience. But, you know, it's one thing that's beautiful is that games can simulate something like that that you can't get in any other experience. You can literally be there.
And the audience is a very passionate audience as well.
Cult-like. And the audience is not dumb. Like, they're smart. And so they can overcome all these obstacles. It's just finding the right people that have that as a desire, something that they want to experience.
Hmm. If there was a Metroid Prime 2 remastered, what quality of life things would you like want added to it? Because I'm sure as a developer, you must look back on every project that you ever do and see the things that you'd want to improve. It's very natural of creative people.
I don't know. Prime 2 is such a product of its time, and some of the frustration points are actually part of the appeal. It's like Demon Souls, Dark Souls are difficult games, but they're consistent and they're fair in their difficulty. Changing some of those elements, like people complain about, you know, the Boost Ball Guardian being a little difficult because you're constantly losing health and there's nothing to gain. So there are things that we could do to tune it. Or I can't say we, but, you know, if they were to make something like that, that they could do to tune it. There's also...
I would think like something simple like checkpoints.
Checkpoints before boss. I mean, basically, there's some stuff that, you know, just bringing over the control scheme updates that were made for
Prime Remastered.
Yeah. Checkpoints being one. Some form of difficulty tuning... potentially just for, because, you know, Dark World atmosphere is, there are some players that just can't get over the hump of going out into a world that kills you by existing in it. And so it generates too much anxiety and fear to be able to just understand that there's a guiding hand there that knows exactly how long it takes for you to reach these destinations, lets you heal when you're bathing in the light of one of the light torches that's there. So I don't know. I don't know anything that wouldn't compromise the identity of the game outside of just the quality of life features with the control scheme and just making it so that it's less frustrating to die and be reset to a checkpoint that's, or not a checkpoint, but a save station that's further back.
I mean, effectively with Prime Remastered, everything is very much the same. They just overhauled the animation, well, not even the animation, but the art, and then they tweaked the animation, and then obviously you've got the controls that are more modern, and that's really about it that they did. So the fundamental design is still intact, which is what would be the same.
Yeah, exactly. My frustration is mostly with the artifact system, the keys. But it's a late game thing that lets you take advantage of the light suit to find the keys. But I think that, you know, maybe there's something that could be done with revealing that there is some form of disturbance in the light world, slash maybe even more of an indication of where the dark keys are to help, you know, guide players to be able to find them more quickly and effectively in the late game.
Yeah, because I think in Prime 1, you can get a lot of the artifacts before the end game. And I think with Prime 2, I think like 9...
Prime 3 solved it with the... Yeah,
with the energy cells.
Yeah, and so I think that that's a better way of doing it. Prime 2 is the game that it is, though. So it's like, you don't want to compromise the integrity of what it is in the past, because that improvement may actually, in fact, anger a bunch of people that liked the way that it was, and because it's a classic remake, you don't want to change it fundamentally. But I think that, you know, subtle things could be done.
Yeah, and I think in the case with the key hunt at the end, you mentioned, is the light suit is intrinsically intertwined with that key hunt. So
yeah,
if you were to remove the keys, then what's the point in having the light suit, so to speak? So they are kind of required. Yeah.
Yep.
I did want to ask, so do you have a favorite boss? Not necessarily that you worked on, but just in the game.
I think my favorite boss is Quadraxis.
I think that's pretty much everybody's.
Yeah.
Yep. Good choice.
And Pacini had sent out an email for who wants to try and name this boss and everything, and so I think I've mentioned it before, but Quadraxis was a name that I came up with because of the quad foreleg, rotates on an axis, sounded cool when you merge them together. So I did a lot of the naming for stuff, and that was a lot of fun. But I built that room. It was close to my heart, and I feel like it is the most iconic and identifiable boss in Prime 2 for me.
I think in the entire series, I think it's the best boss in the entire series, personally. So, and I think a lot of people think that too.
And for me, I have a long history of putting overscaled giant creatures in every game that I work on. So it's like, I am always pushing to have something super large in scale, memorable, or at least, you know, exaggerated. And so that one fulfills that desire for me.
Yeah, the Kynan thumbprint. There you go. Yeah. Do you have a favorite item upgrade?
In Prime 2?
Yeah.
I still think it's probably Dark Beam, even scaled back. Even though I know that that's not or Dark Charge Beam.
Are you talking about the Dark Beam upgrade? I think it's the Dark Burster. Is it the Dark Burster or
it's the charge version of the Dark Beam.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You hold the button down, it charges up when you fire. It hits a surface,
and then
it sends out the particles that scatter and will eventually cluster and freeze an enemy. I love the tuning of when it was OP, and it did like 4 times more than it did in the final game. But yeah, that's probably my favorite.
Okay. Favorite area?
Yeah.
Favorite biome?
Sanctuary Fortress, of course.
Yeah, okay. I thought like, you were going to
I love.
I think everybody loves it.
Yeah, like there's something cool about just the circuitry. Like we had digital rain that went the opposite direction. We had all of the illuminated like neon and basically glowing scrolling texture work that makes it so much more dynamic to look at an area because it just feels high tech. It feels unlike anything, and yeah, super appealing. So. There was an escalation in the game for a reason, and I feel like the escalation happened great in Prime 2.
Well, it feels like the game's in a constant kind of crescendo, and then it peaks at Sectary Fortress. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
It gets to that point, yeah. And that entire section is just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and I love the res bit as an enemy just because of the visor glitch shutdown where you'd have to reboot. But that being said, I still have a soft spot. Andrew did an incredible job on the concepts for things. And I love the duality of the Luminoth and the Ing, and the fact that the Ing represent almost like a hand. So they've got the front leg so that, you know, it's basically, it's got five legs and it's a really eerie thing. But if you think about the dark and light themes about Aether getting split, there's one image that I don't know if it made it into the gallery, but it was basically an Ing hand, an Ing in a hand position at the top of the screen, and a Luminoth kind of hanging below it, and with these subtle guitar string kind of like, or fishing wire, where you just barely see a highlight of where the strings connected from the hand to the Luminoth. And that was always super powerful for me, where it was just like, that's badass. Like, that is cool as hell.
I don't think I've seen that out. I'll have to see if I can find it.
Yeah.
Somebody's bound to have found it.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite puzzle?
Let's see.
I'm guessing it might be something in the Sanctuary Fortress.
Yeah, I'm trying to think through, like, the Sanctuary Fortress had the cool three-ring morph ball tunnel. But I like more of the room that has all of the cylinders with spider ball tracks on them, and that you would, you know, basically it's a large room that you could use a screw attack in, but then it was a primary focus of the spider ball tracks that you would kind of go across. That's being said, I don't necessarily know that that's super puzzle configuration-y. I don't know. I've got to think about that one. When I look back on it, the morph ball stuff just all stands out to me. Even the bridge sequence, I think that was one of Michael Chang's rooms where Dark Samus breaks the bridge as you get into Sanctuary Fortress, and then you have to do the boost ball across all of the stuff where the bridge is missing. I love that area. Like, that was always cool to me.
Do you have a favorite room? Or I suppose they might intertwine.
That's a hard one. there's a room that I like early on in the game that I worked on that I think last time I talked about how Tom Ivy hated me because the room was rotated like 15 or 12.5 degrees or some weird odd number. I don't remember now, but the lens room when you activate the Dark World portal for the first time. So basically you go through the little morph ball sections and then it causes the lenses to rotate into place and you use the lenses as platforms. And then the sunlight shines through, hits the generator and turns on the Dark World portal activation for the first time. Yeah, that being said, you know, Sanctuary Fortress is all so cool that it's hard to pick anyone.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I did have some questions from the community that they wanted to ask you. So we'll see.
Absolutely.
See if you can answer some of them. So there's one here from, this is a weird name, but AC-QU9NG. What was the biggest missed opportunity with Prime 2, in your opinion?
The biggest missed opportunity harkens back to something that I said in our first interview, which is I don't think we got the savings of doing the dark world, light world split where we would reuse rooms, I don't think we got the diversity of changes between the dark world from the light world, and it actually cost us dearly in terms of the quantity of unique art and unique themes that we could have. So I feel like we could have handled something with the dark world, light world transition better to give more variety to the game.
But the intention was there, right? It's just when you actually
tried to implement it,
it ended up being far more difficult than you intended.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's a missed opportunity in so much as having a larger variety of unique rooms rather than the split that gave you some rooms that felt like some of the dark world rooms just didn't feel like thrilling additions where it, you know, it hits you with the same impact that seeing something absolutely new would have been. And that being said, I do love like some of the elements of, you know, we had these scrolling UV textures that almost looked like centipede, where in Dark World, certain things flowed that was eerie and interesting. But I don't think, yeah, I don't think that we created enough absolute 100% like standout landmarks in the Dark World as we could have.
If they do a remastered version of Metroid Prime 2, if they, you know, rebuild the art, could that in a way solve some of that problem, do you think? By making it look a bit more distinctive?
No, because it could change the collision, which then changes the game dramatically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the big thing is like, also, you know, I was at Blue Point for a long time and we did, you know, remaster projects. Doing remaster projects, it's actually more expensive. It seems crazy to say this, but it's harder to fully redo the art of a game that already exists than it is to create impressive art from scratch, because you can use techniques to repeat things and you can find things that you can like do in a unique game where you're making everything exactly as you want it and you can kind of like find creative solutions. When you're just boosting the quality of the existing art and it has to match the original, then there's no shortcuts. So the shortcuts we took when developing Prime 2 was like unique layouts of texture UVs so that we could create patterns and configurations. If you tried to boost those, you literally just have to build them for real at a high quality bar, which means that the techniques that were the cost saving to do the original art don't apply. And so I don't know. I mean, it's like it's an expensive endeavor, I would think, to rebuild something that is absolutely unique, and then also have the and not try to find ways of repeating from Dark World to Light World. So I hope we get it. It'd be thrilling to me to have it, but I don't necessarily know that it solves it.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, I remember with Metroid Prime Remastered during the credits, it just kept scrolling and scrolling, and it really puts into perspective how many people were involved in just making that happen from just updating the art, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Next question. This is from Narcisse, I think. What's with the dark Luminoth in the E3 2004 trailer? Was there an intention? How far into development did it get, and why was it cut?
I have no idea. I don't know. I when you're working on a game, you go through so many different variations of concepts and visualizations and everything that by the time you ship, things have transformed and the reasons for why something exists and all of the evolutions that it's gone through no longer really apply. And so like I may have seen 2,000 iterations on Luminoth. So just one that the public happened to be aware of because of the trailer and the way that the trailer was cut and the visualization. I don't know. And then there's the part of fictionally, like, things change. And so I don't remember that trailer exactly. But that being said, yeah, I don't know that... I don't know that you'll ever really get an answer to that question that would be satisfying, because I'm not certain it. I'm not certain it followed through in the exact same way as, you know, it ended up.
Well, usually when something's cut, I assume there's a very good reason as to why it's cut, or it was improved upon, or it didn't fit because of constraints or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, next question. What were the most difficult puzzles to create, and which puzzles the favorites? Well, you've kind of answered that, but difficult puzzles was like a very, very difficult puzzle.
Difficult puzzles is more, I think, less about the difficulty and more about just the amount of effort that it takes to see it through. And so some puzzles, just the more moving parts there are in a puzzle and the more scripting required to pull it off, basically is just much more development effort. And so some things, you know, like some of the stuff that I talked about with the spider ball tracks, when you have a big moving contraption that has a lot, that has the spider ball tracks on it, and the way that we implemented that, and the fact that you can pull up or down on a spider ball track, and the fact that the camera needs to be oriented a certain way for your controls to work the way that you think, and then you can bomb jump, but then you can also boost off of it, and you need to make all of those things work in all the situations. What happens when the spider ball track takes you into a damaging device? Does that immediately drop you? Does it just damage you and then roll you in the corner? Those are problems that have to be solved to make the physicality and the mechanics of the configuration work in tons of testable circumstances. What happens if you jump at it and then you turn into morph ball while you're falling down, but you're still holding the button to grip? Like, does it pull you back up onto, you know, it's like there's so many layered parts that could go wrong that usually the puzzles that are difficult are the things that have the largest amount of moving parts that have to account for different systems. So anything that has morph ball has to have a morph ball camera set up specifically for it. It has to be tested at every point in time with every directionality that you can hold on the controller. And yeah, there's just any number of things that can go wrong with collision and all that stuff. So I would say a lot of times it's morph ball, specifically spider ball, that makes something a little more difficult.
How long does that usually take? I mean, you probably can't, like, does it take days, weeks, when you've got, like, this incredibly complex system
that's
in place?
It's a hard thing to answer because it differed from game to game based on the setups. So on Prime 2, you know, we would only have 11 days to do the blue room, and then we would do the initial scripting. So it was fully playable. You know, we would lay out the splines and everything to make sure that spider ball tracks worked. But then, you know, you'd have a scripting pass that goes in and then engineering support if something wasn't able to be done effectively with the tools that were available to the designers. And then there's refinement and bug testing, and then art and the changes that art makes sometimes to the layout of a room that need to have, you know, custom solutions to fix problems that get introduced there. And then, you know, there can be triggering of audio and visual effects and music and everything that go along with it. So it'd be impossible to say how much effort goes into any one thing because so many people touch it at different periods of time when it gets handed from one person to another person to another person to another person. And, you know, there's no one size fits all. Everyone is a different answer. Something seems like it could be hard, turns out it was really easy. Something that you had on the schedule that was supposed to take, you know, 2 months could get done in a month. And then something that you had on the schedule that was supposed to be 2 weeks ends up taking, you know, 6 months. It's weird. It's everything is different and unique, and it's not always worked on start to finish. Sometimes it's left for a while, then you revisit it. And then it's staggered, so somebody can't, you know, do the thing that they needed to do immediately. So, yeah, the time ranges vary wildly, and it is inconsistent. You can have intentions, but people will take the amount of time generally that they've been given to work on something. So giving them a little less time up front puts a little more pressure on them to finish it early. And then, you know, you give them more time. if needed. But if you give somebody like 2 months to finish a room, they'll deliver it at the end of 2 months, even if they could have finished it in a day.
That's interesting.
So it's a production. It's both a production aspect and then just the realities of development.
Yeah. But yeah.
Unpredictable for how long things take.
Of course. It just occurred to me that the wall jump rooms, did you have any involvement in that?
Yeah.
You know, how it goes in the screw and tack and then it kind of
yep.
pans to the side and then... Do you remember how long that took? Or because there's not many of those rooms in Prime 2. I know it was heavily expanded on in Prime 3.
I mean, mostly the ones in Luminoth Temple. They were really fast up front and then took a lot of tuning to make sure that the camera had the clearance to be able to pivot to the side so that you could bounce back and forth. I don't know. I know that I think Ryan Harris might have been Ryan Harris or Tom Ivey that did those setups in the game. I don't remember offhand right now, but yeah, most of the time was just in polish. Setting up the room was fast. Getting the mechanic to work right with how long you grip the wall, how the distance when you go back and forth, and then the camera work was the big time constraint.
Hmm. Final question. This is from @theplayer387. If the game was made today, what is something you would have in it that wasn't possible back then? It's a hard one to answer, I think.
That it's an impossible one to answer because, like, we change over time. What I would do is very different from what anybody else would choose to do, and I hate saying I. Like, these games are team efforts.
Oh, there of course, they are. They are. Yes.
And so...
Particularly in those days as well. I just want to quickly say, because obviously back in those days, roles weren't as isolated as they are now, particularly in the big AAA space, right? You'll have... There's a lot of overlap, I would assume, back in those days. And I know you like to go to other people's desks and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
And stuff. Yeah.
I think the big thing... would be that could have been done, pushed a little more, is we had a lot of, like, I don't want to say disturbing, but cosmic horror elements to the game in terms of, like, the form factor of the Ing and the armor and the Dark World and all of these things that are a little more, that make you feel uneasy. Mm. And I think that with the level of fidelity we have now, you could have more articulation, things doing motions that feel that evoke those the kind of like sense of unease and anxiety a little more.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
I think all three games and like even Metroid Fusion does this very well, but like the horror tense aspects, right? Yeah, I mean, you even had spots in Metroid Prime 3 where you did it, with the GFS Valhalla and the Xeno Research Station where the lights go out. And Prime 1, you had the thermal visor section. But it feels like Prime 2 had a lot. The intro section, you know, where you just, I think it's in the second room and you've got Federation soldiers hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there was cool. A lot. That was a lot darker in Prime 2 than I think had previously been. Like, there have always been, because, like, you know, the DNA of Metroid is heavily tied to Aliens,
yes,
Ridley Scott's series. And so, like, there are parallels that can be drawn between some of the visuals and some of that, but the tone. So I think that, yeah, like, pushing up the unease and the horror elements a little more in Prime 2, could have gone a long way.
I'll wrap up there, but just before we go, do you have like a favorite story from the development and any final thoughts?
I don't know that I've shared this one, but one that was funny to me. Like I, you know, I have so many fond memories and there were so many cool people. Like that's the thing is like at the time there were so many technically capable and incredibly talented people there. So like the artists were just like, they were killer. The engineers were all just were incredible. Like once in a lifetime experience working with the designers, like were like, there's not many studios that you can go to where they make games that feel like they have the Nintendo philosophy in regards to an understanding, a deep understanding of mechanics and how your game is built from a design perspective around the mechanics and player acknowledgement, what you do with those things in the world and the reactions that you get that actually leave you with a sense of wonder and awe and that surprise you enough to be like, that's cool, you know? And so like everybody there was awesome. Couple things, fond memories that kind of don't necessarily have to do with dev is like Zoid and I played fighting games every day at lunch. And
I know he's a big Street Fighter guy.
Yeah. And so we would play Third Strike all the time, Super Turbo. We would switch back and forth between a bunch of different fighting games. But I think there's a parallel between perception and skill and a personality type that drives for, you know, healthy competition, fundamental understanding of nuance that you get that if you have somebody that's in dev but is also a fan of fighting games. And so Zoid is an engineer by nature, but has a absolute grasp of an understanding of design mechanics and attention to detail in that regard. And so it's like, and also there's a thing about healthy competition with your friends that makes you push to just do more. It's a competitive spirit where you want to impress people. You want to just implement things and you want to do something that stands out. But the story that I was going to share is Jack at the time, Jack Matthews had it was either a Camaro or a Mustang. I think it was a Mustang. And he had pulled it into the parking lot. Jason Bear had an Outback, a Subaru Outback, and it was kind of parked behind Jack. Jack forgot to put on his parking brake. So his Mustang starts rolling backwards towards Jason's car. Jack made an unfortunate decision to try and stop his car by himself from behind. So he got behind it and he was pushing. And it pushed him into Jason's Outback. And so he luckily did not get pinned, didn't get injured as far as I'm aware. You can ask him for verification on this. Yeah. But what he did leave was an imprint of his butt cheeks pushed into the metal on the back of Jason's Outback. So you had a perfect indent of Jack's rear on the rear of Jason's car.
And, does Jason still have that Outback? Probably not.
No, of course not. But that was a long time ago.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he does. I don't know. I can't say of course, but yeah. So that was just one of those funny things that, you know, you had to be there.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask him about it. Yeah. that's hilarious. Well, I suppose in those situations, you just act on instinct, right? You're not necessarily thinking.
Yeah, I'm glad he wasn't hurt.
Oh, yeah.
That was the benefit. And there were, I think he's probably shared this story, but there were times where, you know, there was a rule where you couldn't have all of the engineers in the same vehicle going to lunch because I think somebody had gotten into an accident with four engineers in the car. And then it was just like, if this had gone wrong and, you know, it was not something that people walked away from, that could have wiped out development, you know, because we were... It wasn't like huge amount of the development team at that time, you know, like Retro was still fairly small.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know why that tangent came up, but anyways, it was one of those things where, you know, we didn't put everyone on the same plane at the same time and all of that, where we had to start taking it a little more seriously and professionally.
Well, it's a smart thing to do though, because you never know. You never know.
Yep.
Yep. Cool, Conan. This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out to do this. I love Metroid Prime 2. I think the bosses are still one of the biggest highlights. Sanctuary Fortress is still one of the biggest highlights, one of the best biomes in the series, period. And you guys did a phenomenal job. And I hope they remaster it one day, because I'd like for it to get a second wind, so to speak. And because it's still trapped on kind of the GameCube, Wii, and Wii U, so I would like to...
I mean, I would always love for people to be able to continue to play things. I think that there's a game preservation thing where I hope that it's made available in some form in the future. That'd be stellar because it's an important part of my life. Retro had basically the baby boom after that, where like so many people on the staff ended up having kids all at the same time. Don't know why, but it's a beautiful memory for me that I look back on and think fondly, and it's something that, you know, like can't be done again. Like there's no studio that I can think of that would make a game like that and has the same situation of just like where technology was, the amount of talent that was on the team in the same place at the same time, and even decisions that would be made. Now we're informing things with data, so it's just kind of like, you know, there was something very that game is what it is because of the people and the time that it was made, and nobody would make those same decisions again, realistically. And we've learned lessons from it moving on. So I think that it had to happen in the way that it did. And so I do look back on it very fondly. So many amazing memories and so many amazing people and so much that I learned at that time that, yeah, it's just absolutely another time. And yeah. Sorry for the rambly answers.
No,
and everything,
that's good. Yeah. And like, it wouldn't have been easy as well because Prime 1 was so well regarded. You know, it had like 97 on Metacritic or something. I mean, the amount of expectation that would have been on you guys, the pressure. It wouldn't have been easy to deliver.
It was a difficult schedule to hit.
Yes.
And, you know, I nearly lived at Retro. I was a lot younger at the time, and it was all, you know, based on just wanting to do the best stuff that we could. But, yeah, like, it was a very short development cycle considering what, you know, it was following after Prime. But everybody, you know, like, even though it was difficult and everyone worked a lot of hours, not as much as they did on the original Prime. Or at least most people, I think, found a more healthy balance. But team was still small, timeline was short, and everyone was still swinging for the fences trying to make the best game that we could. Yep. So
I think it's underrated. Similar to like Majora's Mask, how Prime 2 and Majora's Mask tend to live in the shadow of, you know, Ocarina of Time, Metroid Prime, but I do feel like they are very underrated. And you did an awesome job.
Warms my heart to hear you say that, and I do love the fact that I hear from people from time to time where it's one of their favorite, if not their favorite, Metroid game. But I don't have the expectations of that. I know that like it fills a niche for those that are passionate about it that you can't get it anywhere else, and it really has its own tone that is separate. Mostly from almost everything else in the Metroid series. So,
Definitely agree. There's nothing else like it. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.